This episode of The Orb is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine show. I'm Christopher Jones, and joining me as he is every single week is Matthew Rushing. Matthew, here, I brought this can of Lurian hair growth formula. You left it the last time we recorded. You left it behind.
Chris, are you sure this is mine? I mean, we see each other every week when we record, and if I add any more hair to this head, I'm going to look like Cousin It.
So, my evil scheme comes to the surface. All right, Matthew. Well, here we are. We have been doing, for most of this year, we've been doing our series on the final chapter. And we're one show later than usual getting to the final chapter discussion. But that's because this is the big one, What You Leave Behind. And we're going to go all out on this because there's so much that we want to talk about in the episode, and in terms of the final chapter wrap-up. This is going to be a two-parter. So we're going to have part one here this week, and the next show we'll have part two for everyone.
Well, you know, Chris, we have those movies. Everybody's doing two parts of the last episode, you know, of your film. So Harry Potter was in part, you know, two parts. You're doing that with the Hunger Games. You did it with Twilight. We're just following Twilight's example.
Yeah, but there's a big difference between them and us, Matthew. We're not actually selling this, and so we're not, you know, trying to get double the box office or double the merchandise sales by splitting it into two parts unnecessarily.
Dang you and your logic.
Yeah, I've been hanging around Vulcans too long.
Oh, goodness.
So, Matthew, you know, a lot of times when we talk about episodes, we get into a lot of the details and a lot of the behind-the-scenes stuff, and I'm sure we'll talk about some of that today as well, but as I was rewatching this episode for the umpteenth time this morning, it really hit me that this episode is so much about your own emotional investment in the series and what the storylines mean to you and what the characters mean to you and what the series means to you, that I think I want to talk largely just about our own impression of what happens in the episode and how we feel about it, and maybe not quite as much of the nuts and bolts as we sometimes get into here, just because it's really an emotional moment watching What You Leave Behind.
Chris, it's funny that you mentioned that because I was noticing this rewatch, and, you know, sometimes for episodes I don't have to rewatch the episode that we talk about because I've seen it 1,000 times, but I always want to watch this one again. And mainly because every time I watch it, I am placed back in that emotional state that I was in when this episode aired. And it's one of elation and just heartbreak all at the same time, because I'm leaving behind something that's meant a lot to me. And for the first time in Star Trek, when a show ended, obviously the original series ended like crap. You know, it's the Turnabout Intruder with, you know,
Yeah, it wasn't really a planned ending, right? It's just the last episode.
Yeah, that's exactly. It. Well, and then too, with The Next Generation, you know, I was even listening to Larry Nemechek's Trekland speaker and listening to the guys talk about the difference between The Next Generation and this series was, is The Next Generation, we know we're just going to hop right into the movies. There is a feeling of expectation of what is to come.
Right.
With Deep Space Nine, there's none of that. We all feel that this is going probably be the last time that we see these characters.
Yeah.
And
well, like talking about All Good Things, so it has a wonderful final scene, and they do pull out of the ship from the poker table, but then the ship goes off, but you know that they're just going off to the next adventure, right? And you're going to be with them still. But when they pull away from that window with Jake and Kira, and they pull away from the station, it's like they're closing the book. They're actually closing the back cover of the book, and it's the end of the story. But yet, it doesn't end in a way that makes you feel like the story's over, but you just know that you've reached the end, and life will go on there, but you will no longer see what happens.
It's funny because it just really mirrors life, that bittersweet ending that happens, where there's going to be a continuation. It's much like when you leave your home and move to a new home or move to a new state. All of that life still continues back home when you're gone. And yet you're not there to experience it with all of those people. And the same thing happens with Deep Space Nine. You do feel like all of these people are going to go off and do different things. Certain people are still there on the station, and yet I don't get to be a part of it anymore. And one of the creators there, the special effects guys on Trekland Speaker, said he felt like this was a terrible title, What You Leave Behind. And yet I think this is a fantastic title because are leaving our hearts on Deep Space Nine. Tony Bennett says he left his heart in San Francisco. I really feel like I left mine on Deep Space Nine.
Exactly. I think that's how so many of us feel when we're watching it. We're going to talk about the characters primarily in the second part of this discussion, but we do have to start out here with just the cold opening, which I know for you is probably the best cold opening in all of Star Trek because Ezri's just there in bed, popping up out of the sheets.
Yeah, it's fantastic, Chris. Ezri's not even wearing any pants, so
which is going to sound really weird to those who don't know that on the network, before we record any show, we always do our mic checks by saying something something pants.
Which was fantastic for this episode because the very first scene, Bashir and Ezri not wearing any pants. But it is a great opening, and this is what kind of actually moves us back to what we were talking about, what you were with the final resolution.
Yeah.
This, when I was watching this episode, I'm noticing that there are a lot of lingering moments, small character moments in this episode. I think more so than you would expect from a big, bold Deep Space Nine episode that's ending it all. Part of that is this episode wasn't as big as they wanted it to be because of budgetary cuts and time crunch. I think the other reason is because they understand, Ira Stephen Baer understands, this show is about these characters and where they've come from Emissary to What You Leave Behind.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, you have things like Quark just sitting in Vix talking to Vic in the middle of everything else that's going on. They actually take the time just to have that little moment there.
It's a beautiful moment because there is such a difference between the Quark that we're seeing there and the Quark that we saw in the first season. That's one of the things that you'll notice in just about every scene that they do is I feel like they're kind of putting the character mirrors up and giving them a way to show just how much they grow and how far they've come in the show. And it makes for a very fulfilling feeling when you leave, you know, even as they pull away from Deep Space Nine, that beautiful scene that, gosh, it's an emotional scene when they pull away and it's Kira and Jake, and they're the two ones who have been left behind by his father. The one who looks at him as the emissary to her people, and the other one who looks to him as dad. And And yet those two characters are also a lot closer than you would have ever thought they would be because of what happened in season six. So it is a wonderful thing that they do with all of these moments in this show. And gosh, I get emotional thinking about it, and even just talking to you, Chris, because they do it so well.
Yeah, absolutely. So we'll get more into the characters as we go through this, and again, mostly in the second part of our discussion here. In terms of the big events in this episode, though, if we're talking about the real meat of the story that concludes the final chapter and the Dominion War, Damar's Last Stand and the Cardassian Resistance is a really big part of that. One thing that struck me again this time, Matthew, was how early in the episode the big battle begins. Like, I kind of always feel like the big space battle happens later on in the story, but it really is up there towards the front. And then, of course, we pick up with Damar and Garrick and Kira there as well. And one other thing, this is interesting. So, of course, Damar dies in this episode, and he's the first one to go of the main characters. And there's the scene, I love this image too, of Miles with the Alamo that he and Julian have built in his quarters. And he's holding up the little Travis character. And in Casey Biggs, who plays Damar, played Travis in the IMAX version of the Alamo. And he's the first to die there. And I've never thought about this before, and I don't know if it was intentional or not, but just Miles dwelling on Travis and then Damar being the first to fall is an interesting little parallel.
It really adds, I think, Miles and Julian have had that annihilation fantasy, as he calls it, where they
keep
playing.
I thought you were going to call it a toy, and I was going to warn you that this is not a toy.
Oh, no, it's a model. But that annihilation fantasy and seeing it, that all the things that they play out in the holodeck together. Whereas we're actually going to see that play out in this episode with a no-win scenario for these characters. And they know that either all of them die or most of them die. And it just happens to be Damar. But it's also poetic and beautiful because, you know, Damar will go on to be a legend at that point and right, a rallying point for his people. And so his death is, I'm not going to say that he couldn't have done as much with his life if he had lived, but his death, I think, will live on in a way that his life maybe never could, because he doesn't have a time to screw it up at this point. He'll always be the legend. He'll always be the thing that people look up to.
So you're thinking that maybe Damar would have screwed things up if he had lived?
No, not, you know what I'm saying. I mean, everybody has the ability to destroy their reputation by doing one stupid thing. You know, just look at plenty of famous people, whether politically or whatnot, throughout history, they've had that opportunity and some of them have done it. So, but I'm just saying that the beauty of what happens to Damar is that his character arc is full, but his liberation of Cardassia, it goes, he helps create a brand new Cardassia in which he is the legend with which it will be built upon.
I did want to ask you as well here, as we talk about Damar's Last Stand, what you thought about the little, what I feel like are Star Wars references, because I know you love Star Wars as well. First of all, talking about the Resistance, Wayun says, how is that possible? We've destroyed all of their rebel bases.
Yeah.
And then when it looks like Damar and Garrick are going to be arrested, Princess Leia, I mean Kira, comes to their rescue because she shoots them, and she's wearing the Breen helmet, and then she opens up the front, and it's just like Leia taking off the Bosch helmet.
And that scene, as well as, aren't you a little short to be a stormtrooper? And right, Luke pulls off the helmet. Yeah, so it's been played a few times. What we didn't talk about, though, is, hey, you know, maybe, I feel bad, you know, maybe Damar could have had a future with Mila. You know, she seemed to have been in love there. I love that scene. It's one of those great character moments they create right before they kill Mila, and you feel terrible. but the whole way that scene is set up, the character of Dumar, and just how different he is, how different you're looking at him in that scene, it's just it's brilliant. And his last stand with the Cardassian resistance, it culminates in something that I don't know if we would have ever expected, you know, when we first saw him in Scream.
Do you feel like Dumar's death was too understated, though? They're just in a firefight, and then he's killed. And it's just like, yeah, he's dead. And then they move on. I mean, does that place it in the fact that while he's the leader, he's sort of the everyday man leading the charge for his people, rather than being this leader up at the top? Or do you think that there should have been more made out of his sacrifice?
I think his death will have more made of it later on. But in that firefight,
for the viewer, like you've been,
right.
It's been building towards this throughout the final chapter. So when you get to that moment as the viewer, how did you feel?
I actually felt like they did a good job of creating a realism that doesn't usually happen in this kind of medium. You know, Star Trek usually tends to go towards that more hero worship moment where you give the guy a good death. But here, you know, he doesn't even really get out he gets out one last word. And it's not this big, long death scene or anything like that. I mean, it's quick. And I was watching it today and I just thought, wow, I think this is great that the death of Dumar is quick and dirty. You know, it's not drawn out and it's very realistic. And it just moves them forward. And then the reaction around him, I think, is fantastic. What Kira says, you know, remember his last, you know, command. We don't stop until, you know, basically we're all dead or we've won. And then, of course, Garak just yells viscerally, which I thought was a great response, too, for Cardassia. You know, his death has a motivating impact on the rest of the characters there. But it's not his death that's focused on it. It's what happens after it. So I don't know. I thought it was really well done. Were you hoping to maybe see more? Or?
I don't know if I was really hoping to see more necessarily. It's so, like you say, it's realistic. I mean, that happens, right? Someone's there. They're the leader, but they're within the group and they get hit and they're dead. I think that just within Star Trek, it felt very understated. Okay, like surprisingly understated for television and for Star Trek, maybe, that it happens. And if you were just kind of halfway watching it, you might not realize that Dumar got killed right there. If you weren't really, and I don't mean staring at it, but I mean, like, if you just have it playing and you're doing something else, that fact might slip by you at first. And then you realize, oh, Dumar's not with them anymore. As opposed to making a big deal about him as the leader of the Cardassian resistance, because the female changeling in Wayun have ordered people to find him and bring him here. You know, there he is the prize target, and yet he just falls.
I think that it's, like you said, it happens really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And what was best about it is that Dumar was the first one through the door.
Right.
You know, he was the one leading the men.
Yeah,
he was the one leading the charge. And, you know, he wasn't asking anyone to do anything that he wouldn't do or do it better, you know, as the leader.
Well, I think it contrasts his Cardassia and Dukat's Cardassia, right? Because Dukat, he's not doing it for himself, right?
Mm-hmm.
He led the charge, like you said. He was the first one in and he was killed. Dukat, everything would have been for him, right? And all of Cardassia would have really been pawns for him, just as they are for the Dominion.
Oh, definitely. And that is a clear distinction, I think, as well, of what they're playing with Garak later, too, when he has that conversation with Bashir about, you know, and he also has the conversation with Kira about how his Cardassia is dead, and at this point it's for revenge, and the different motivations behind these people. And it is interesting that of all the Cardassians that we've seen, I love that it is Dumar who was the truest Cardassian of them all. He was the one who never gave up on Cardassia, and it was always for Cardassia, because even when he was working for Dukat, he thought he was doing it for Cardassia. It just turned out he was working up for a megalomaniac.
Right.
And he didn't know it until later on. So I think it's really cool to see that.
Still talking about the Cardassian resistance, what about the position that the female changeling especially is taking towards them? Not only that, but the action to destroy a city, and they kill 2 million people, just like that. And then, when the Cardassians switch sides, and the female changeling wants to just annihilate them all entirely, what was your take on the Cardassian switching side first? And then, I found it interesting that the Breen still stand by. Like, what are the Breen thinking? They think that somehow the female changeling is going to just completely annihilate every single Cardassian, destroy the planet, but somehow that's never going to bleed over to them.
I think that the Breen feel that they've made a good deal, and as long as they stay loyal and never show any hint of resistance, that they're going to get what they want, which is to control all these worlds. You know, they even ask for control of Earth, you know, and she's, I mean, literally the female changeling would give up her soul if she had some sort of shape-shifting soul to win the Alpha Quadrant, to win the war. And that's pretty much what she admits to Wei-Un. You know, I don't care.
Being loyal didn't work for Broca. They hauled him away and executed him.
But at that point, too, they don't trust any Cardassians. You know, it's the last straw.
Well, that's where I feel they're going to turn on the Breen as well.
Oh, yeah. And I think that was one of the things that... And this harkens back to our discussion that we've had of In the Pale Moonlight. Mm-hmm. And Sisko making, I think, the right decision, because he understands the psychology of the Founders, that it's their order or no order. You know, like, it's either us or nothing. And therefore, in the end, they're going to be subjugating everyone, not just the people they fought against. So it's very much that kind of Star Wars idea, again, of the Empire. You know, the Emperor comes into power and all these people think it's going to be a good thing and they support him.
Right.
When he comes to power and, has all the Jedi killed. And then people are like, oh, frack. You know, like when they realize who they've got. So yep. I think the same thing happens with the Dominion. The Dominion comes in like a snake, and then people are surprised when it bites them.
I suppose a lot of worlds in the Gamma Quadrant, they know the Dominion's reputation, and that as long as you play along, maybe things will be good for you, right? As long as you don't resist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And probably no one is powerful enough to even think about challenging them in the first place.
No, definitely not. And... you know, I think that really kind of leads us into that idea of, do you finish the war, mm-hmm. or do you not finish the war? And the three main leaders have a really big decision. And I love that it comes down to Sisko. I mean, this guy who started off as a commander, not even a captain, and in 4 years, he's the one with an admiral and a chancellor making the call at the end of the war. How fantastic is that? Like, for a captain, I mean, we've never seen a captain in any Star Trek show have this much power over the course of events in Star Trek universe.
Yeah, maybe. The one exception I could think of might be, say, Picard taking command of the fleet in First Contact. Like, there are all of these ships there, but all the captains of all the other ships knew that, okay, the admiral ship was destroyed. Picard is taking command of the fleet. We're all going to follow what he says. There was no debate. Like, no, I should be in charge.
Yeah, exactly. So, and in here, I mean, in the end, it's a chancellor and a captain kind of nudging an admiral into making a move. You know, that we get a brilliant picture of just how pivotal these certain captains have been in their respective series. And this, I think, really puts Sisko up there by giving him some strategic thinking beyond what we see for even like a Picard or Kirk or Janeway, any of these characters. You know, Sisko is thinking big picture.
Yeah.
You know, the entire Alpha Quadrant. How does this all work? How do all these pieces fall in together? And the fact that he has been the aide of an admiral in the time of war, running the war effort, you know, really just speaks to how talented he is thinking in these kind of...
And that was set up, too, already. Yep. You know, that wasn't just out of the blue here. If we go back to the beginning of season six, we knew that Sisko had this ability to strategize and really see the big picture. And it's why I think that Ross and Starfleet trust him so much in the war effort. In the they kind of got lucky, right? That when they sent him to Deep Space Nine, they had no idea that it would be a truly important installation on a galactic scale. It was just this station in the backwoods at Bajor with this one planet that wanted to join the Federation. And it just turns out that they happened to send just the right person there who had all those skills.
they sent him there to get Bajor ready for Federation membership. What they didn't realize is that the Prophets had sent him there to protect Bajor and the rest of the Alpha Quadrant from something even worse than the Dominion.
Exactly.
So,
well, going back to what you said, you know, fight or fall back, finishing the war, I found it really interesting, the decision that they made here, because, and remember that they made the decision before they knew that the Dominion fleet had encircled Cardassia Prime and was destroying the cities. They made the decision before they had that information. I feel like that the default mode for Star Trek up to this point would be to fall back. You're in this war. There have been, I guess, billions of casualties at this point. And your enemy is falling back. Not only falling back into their own, behind their own lines, but they're really falling back to one location, to where their headquarters is. And so maybe you feel like the approach that the Romulans considered earlier on in the series, that let them fall back behind the lines, we'll keep them in check, and we'll just let the war kind of end this way, and then we'll go about our lives. I feel like that's the default mode for Star Trek, because that's the more peaceful solution, right? Like, we don't want to prolong a war if we don't have to. But here, Sisko and Martok especially, and they convince Ross that we have to finish this, because if we don't finish this now, it's going to resurface later. And also, this was 1999, and 3 years before this, in 1996, we had First Contact, where Picard also took the position that we're not going to fall back anymore. We're going to take the fight to the Borg, and we're going to finish this. And it's like we were in a period where the writers were really challenging the status quo of Star Trek.
I think that maybe Picard and Sisko had been talking, and you know, they
little
they
subspace
realized,
chatter.
Yeah, exactly.
On the space
talking
Twitter?
About the word. Yeah. You know, at emissary to the Prophets. Said,
probably by DM though, Matthew, because you don't
yeah,
want the Dominion
probably,
to,
yeah,
you know, be reading that.
Exactly. And then, you know, at Enterprise E Captain, and just talking back
with,
and forth. About,
with two N's because someone had already taken the name Enterprise E Captain with one N.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Picard was like, damn.
I knew I should have signed up for this Twitter thing when Troy told me to last month.
Oh, man.
All right. So anyway, what do you think about this? I mean, like, challenging the status quo. I really feel like they were doing that a bit.
I think that in Star Trek, they really had gone to a more pragmatic view of the universe. And Deep Space Nine really helped that to happen. And you kind of see it a little bit in the TNG films, but obviously it's really playing itself out in Deep Space Nine. And this isn't, you know, and what's so interesting too, this isn't the moment of Picard being like, and I will make them pay for what they've done. You know, that's not Sisko's attitude here. The attitude is, we have to finish this, because if we don't, it will just be another war with, you know, billions more dead, and we can make sure that those billions survive. if we could just put it to a stop now.
Right. And even though we might lose 40% our force.
Exactly. And I think that this is why there's the quote that Ross gives in the wardroom about, let us not forget what we fought so hard to earn, and let us make something out of this peace.
Yeah, he says to preserve in peace what we've won in war.
Exactly. And that is a big and bold statement, because this war here is really mirroring, you know, say World War II.
Yeah.
For us.
Yeah, very much.
And in really the last war that people could really get behind and feel like, yeah, we had to fight that war. It had to be done. In this Dominion War, it was a war we had to fight. It had to be done. And this is kind of that U.S. decision. We have to make sure that this ends, you know.
Yeah.
So we luckily,
well, you know,
there's no more space battles because they can't afford it. So we're just going to have Odo beam down and he'll cure the changeling. It'll be fine.
You know, speaking of the U.S. deciding this war has to end in World War II and bombing Japan with atomic bombs, when the Dominion starts bombing the Cardassian cities, especially the first one, and they kill 2 million people, it felt a little bit like a parallel there, except it's being done by a different side for a different purpose. But it's, you know, they're not trying to end the war. They're trying to annihilate the Cardassians. In that case, where I think the U.S. wasn't trying to annihilate the Japanese, they were trying to end the war. They were trying to say, look, we have to do something bold. And this is not a justification in any way. And remember, I live in Japan and I've stood in the middle of Hiroshima. But it was a statement of, we have to bring this to an end somehow. There has to be some sort of statement. But because, like you said, this whole Dominion War, especially the way it plays out here at the very end, it does feel very much like a World War II scenario. There's some imagery, there are some themes from that war that find their way in here, but they're used in different ways within the story by different sides.
And it does a good job. I mean, we start off this show with a planet who's been through occupation for 50 years, referencing obviously what we see with Germany, I think, and the Nazi regime with the Jews. Really hearkening to that. And then we end it with a annihilation of a species almost, and the Cardassians. So we're talking 800 million dead.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a staggering number of Cardassians die. And that means that population is most likely cut in half, if not, you know, this is a fourth of their population maybe left, you know, maybe even less. You know, so when Garrick is talking to Bashir, what's happened to his society because of their arrogance that he talks about is staggering.
Yeah.
It's staggering.
Well, and it's not even a numbers thing with how many people are left. Imagine on Earth right now, if, let's say, only a quarter of the human population were wiped out, but New York and Los Angeles and London and Paris and Tokyo and Berlin and Beijing, like all these cities are wiped out. There might still be 3/4 of the population left, but the entire infrastructure of the global civilization would be destroyed. So they didn't annihilate the Cardassian people, but they talked about in the Deep Space Nine Companion how, and I thought this was great too. There's the scene with Sisko and Ross and Martok, and Martok is drinking, and it's a victory for him, and it's a glorious moment for him. And Ross and Sisko just pour the blood wine out, because for them, they can't be jubilant in victory when there are all these bodies around everywhere. And I thought that really showed that although we cooperated in the war, once that's done, we get right back to the difference between humans and Klingons. But they said in the Deep Space Nine Companion that they wanted to remind the viewers that the Bajorans may see what happened to the Cardassians as poetic justice. But really, what happened to the Cardassians is on such a larger scale that the Cardassians are not nice people and they're not likable. But still, as humans, I think we never want to see anyone suffer to that extent.
I'd definitely say it's poetic justice.
Yeah.
But I'd also say I don't think anybody deserves to suffer like that, no matter what they've done.
Yeah, it's so extreme, right?
It is so extreme. Justice needs to be done, and we should do it swiftly, but that doesn't mean we have to revert to
But in any situation, you're talking about the civilian population being the ones who are really suffering, rarely are they the ones that are really involved.
What I do like, though, is, and I think Garrick hits on this, is that the Cardassian civilization is one that has been ridiculously arrogant to the point of and this is the whole thing, you know, Chris, we talked about this being the final resolution. This is one of the big parts of Deep Space Nine, is that evil defeats evil. You know, the Dominion's actions are the ones that bring about its own doom. The Paw Wraith's actions are the ones that bring about their own doom. Mm-hmm. You know, that evil in the end will end up destroying itself. And the arrogance and those bad virtues that have had free reign on Cardassia for as long as it's been a superpower in the galaxy have now brought it low. And you either are going to learn from that and move your civilization away from that, or you're going to get embittered and emboldened to just, you know, be worse the next time. And I think, you know, what we see is that people like Garrick and Dumar are moving Cardassia towards a new future, because they're going to mourn the loss of the art and literature and all that they brought to the universe that was great. And at the same time, they're going to realize there's so much about us that needs to change. And I think that's a beautiful story, because we can see ourselves in the Cardassians then, because we're not the Federation at this point. We're more like all of the other races out there than we are the Federation at this point.
Yeah, the humans of the Federation.
We can see all of our different terrible, bad virtues, to say, you know, like our vices.
Yeah.
In the Cardassians, or, you know, the Founders, or we can see them in the Ferengi. We've got all of this great canvas that we're played out in the galaxy. We're really not the Federation at this point.
Right.
We're everybody else. So, you know, it's really beautiful.
While you were talking there, it just made me wonder what Dumar was trying to do and what Garrick's trying to do to move the Cardassian people away from this path that's destroying them. For the Dominion, they also need to move away from that path. And it happens by, at the end, Odo linking with and curing the female changeling, and then going to the Great Link and going into the Great Link, where he's going to also cure them. But you saw when he linked with the female changeling, she agreed. We don't hear a conversation, of course, but it's between them. She agreed to stand trial and accept responsibility for her actions. Do you feel like there's maybe sort of a magical solution to the Dominion side of things, where Odo can just somehow go in and suddenly they're going to decide that, all this stuff we've been doing is kind of bad. Maybe we shouldn't do that anymore.
I hope so.
but that's not realistic, though.
I would say it's not realistic unless you have 800 million people less in your civilization. And I think you have an opportunity.
Well, but you're talking about the Cardassians at that point. Right. I'm talking about what's not realistic is on the Dominion side. There's just a magical solution that Odo can merge with them and they're going to change their ways. Whereas on the Cardassian side, of course, that is realistic, and it's not easy because they have to really work.
I think that maybe it's not a magical solution, but I do think that the thing that Odo was able to transfer to the female shapeshifter was all of the experiences he's had since he betrayed the solids.
Okay.
And them accepting him back.
Since he betrayed the Great Link.
No. Since, remember, he betrays Kira. He betrays...
Okay, during the Dominion occupation.
Yeah, exactly. All of those experiences past that, she's able to, once they link, she has those experiences as well with her and realizes that maybe that solids are more trustworthy and more accepting than she thought. And she can then trust the Federation in a way that she wouldn't have been able to do before.
Okay. That makes
sense. So to me, it's not so much of a magical solution as it is they've very subtly worked in the way with which this makes sense. And that way that she could say, okay, we'll stand down. And they have already made a point by saying that for them, one of their own coming home, the 100 that they sent out, means more to them than the rest of the Alpha Quadrant and the rest of the galaxy.
Yeah. Well, and she does say earlier in the story that she doesn't care so much that she's personally going to die from this disease. It's the fact that all of her people are dying from the same disease and she can't do anything about it.
Well, and isn't that a very, I mean, in the end too, that's pretty a human response.
Yeah, it was a surprising statement from her.
So
I thought,
but I think it just goes to show how much they value themselves.
Themselves, yeah, right.
And we have no idea of how shapeshifters work in the sense that are those the only, you know, shapeshifters out there, and like that those are the only founders. They can't make more. They don't actually breed.
Well, we have had this discussion before here on the show, Matthew, a long time ago about the founders, and we debated a bit whether or not they are simply one large entity that can manifest itself as multiple individuals from our perspective, but that somehow it is just a collective consciousness, in which case that makes more sense that Odo can link with her, transfer those thoughts, and even go back and merge back into the Great Link and then change the way that the entire Link itself thinks.
Right. And so that ambiguity, I guess, it takes away that kind of magicalness.
Yeah, maybe
so. And so.
Well, let's move on because we have two other things we want to touch on here. I did want to talk about One Last Night in Vix because for me, I've seen this episode so many times and I feel like every time I watch it, the scene in Vix with everyone and then later the montage as well, it's just more moving every time I watch it. And you would think that it would become less moving because you know what's coming up and you're already accustomed to the fact that this is their last time together. And yet it just keeps delivering this emotional impact every single time.
When Vic is singing and he kind of comes down and he stands right in front of Odo and Kira and he sings, you know, and that laugh that crinkles your nose. And it's just so perfect. The way Nana, I remember Ira Stephen Bear saying on the Trekland speaker about how she was having a hard time not crying the whole time they're filming and everybody else is kind of having that hard time. But just the way that she responds and kind of the way Odo kind of leans into her a little bit closer, it's perfect. And that scene is perfect from the speech that Avery gives as Sisko to the way that Worf is insisting that you should move to Minsk. For the O'Briens.
Have you considered Minsk?
Minsk. And he keeps saying it, like, because it's classic Worf. And it's just, it really is. The whole scene is so beautifully shot. And it does make it hard to talk about it. Like, it makes it hard to watch every time.
Yeah.
Because, again, you're leaving a group of people that has come to mean more than I think ever had other Star Trek characters mean as a group. That's the other thing about Deep Space Nine. It's not just the individual characters, but it's the way they all play into each other as the whole that makes it so beautiful. And all of the characters beyond that have made up this incredible tapestry. And to me, it's brilliant.
What's interesting about that scene is it feels less like a scene on a set for a TV show and more like the after party, like after the show wrapped and they got together and they just filmed that, because you've got everyone in there, in the crowd, in the bar, the lounge, I guess I should say. You've got the writers, you've got other actors who played different aliens out of makeup at those tables. It really is like a celebration of everyone who worked on that show in an actual lounge with James Darren, who's an actual singer, up there singing to them. And it just feels so incredibly natural. And you can imagine, because I believe that is the last thing that was shot, you can imagine the emotions going through everyone's minds as they know that that's it. That's the end of this show.
Well, and what was so beautiful about it too is that, you know, all the writers from the show and the producers are all sitting there as well. And the entire Deep Space Nine family is in that room. And so the emotion, I think, pours out of the screen in a way that it hasn't happened on any other show. And it is a really, really fantastically wonderful scene.
Yeah.
And it is a little bit sad in some ways that that's just not the final scene of the episode.
Well, see, that's the thing too. The other thing I want to talk about is the montage of scenes from over the course of the series, which is something I normally don't like when TV shows do this, but in this case it works really, really well. And you tend to feel like these two are connected. Like there's the scene in the lounge and then it goes into the montage. That's sort of how I always think about it. They're actually separated very far apart in this episode. If you watch this episode straight through as it originally aired, which is just one part, you know, one long story. And I'm watching that montage, and it hit me today when I'm watching it that as much as I love All Good Things, and I think it's one of the greatest moments in television history, and it's just a brilliant episode, and everything came together, I'm watching them looking back at the characters, because what the montage does is it just reminds you one last time that even though there's this war going on, there's all this other stuff that happened in this series is about the characters and their relationships with each other. And I was just thinking that I love All Good Things, but the writers never came close before or ever again to capturing the storytelling magic that they did in this finale.
They did not. There is no comparison. And part of that was, again, the difference between what we were going to see on TNG and the fact that we knew we were going to be getting more films. So this really isn't goodbye to these characters.
Right.
It's just it's a whole new world with them. Whereas with this, we know this is the finale. And as Ira said to Larry when he was talking to him, you know, we may see this happen in novels, who knows? But we definitely know that the money they were spending on TNG, we knew we were getting more Stewart. Money they're spending on us, we know we're not getting more Brooks.
Right.
So it's unfortunate that we knew that, I think, with what they were doing. But at the same time, what they give us to wrap everything up, it is just brilliant and beautiful.
Yeah, but the thing is that even though they had some incredible budget restraints on this finale, which is shocking because you would think the studio would just give them whatever they needed for the finale of the show, but they didn't. It doesn't come through for me in the story at all. Like, if I didn't know that was the case, I would just look at this and think, wow, they just put together the most incredible episode. And so the fact that they're able to work through all of that and still give us what they gave us is truly amazing.
Yeah. I listened to the Trekline speaker on the way home this last weekend, and I was by myself because I left my fiance in Portland so she'd get ready for the wedding.
Well, that sounds like either the name of a movie or a country music song, Matthew. Left my fiance in Portland.
It does kind of sound like that. So I'm listening to it on the way home and realizing that, and knowing that they did not have as much money to do this, is obviously TNG was given pretty much unlimited funds. They were like,
yeah, it was kind of just whatever. Yeah.
And mainly because they also knew they needed to make it big and bold and brassy, because they wanted people to go see the movie that was going to be coming out.
Yeah.
It is amazing what they were able to do with this show. And it could have been bigger, but that doesn't necessarily always mean it was better. And right. Star Trek has proved that you don't need to have money to make things awesome. I mean, just look at Star Trek II, The Wrath of Khan. They don't have a ton of money, but they make do with what they've got, and they make an incredible film.
Yeah.
Motion Picture had a ton of money, and they overspent. It didn't make a great film.
Well, some of the best moments in What You Leave Behind are just, you know, the quiet moments of Kira and Odo walking down the corridor talking.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's what they understood, is that, okay, we don't have a lot of money, so what is this show really about? Well, it's about the characters. So as long as we give people great character moments, they're going to love this episode.
Definitely. One thing I also noticed, Matthew, is I'm surprised I've never noticed this before. I noticed today that you can actually read the writing on Vic Fontaine's microphone as he's singing in the lounge. And he's using the exact same microphone that I use to record our podcasts.
That's awesome. That's really cool, Chris. So you and Vic Fontaine are one and the same.
That's right. It's not a big surprise. I use a Shure SM58, which is... it has been the industry standard stage mic for many, many decades, 40 or 50 years now, I think. So no big surprise, but I had never noticed it before. So I thought that was kind of funny to see that. Okay. Last thing to talk about here, Matthew, we told everyone this was going to be a big show. It's What You Leave Behind. The showdown in the fire caves. We've talked about throughout the final chapter and in other shows, how as Deep Space Nine went along, we shifted more and more and more towards mythology and the good versus evil that we see play out in stories throughout history. And it really does just come down to that here, where Dukat is possessed by the Paw Wraiths again. He's been chosen as their emissary. Sisko is the emissary of the prophets. And he's told, of course, by Sarah, that, well, she tells him a couple of things. She tells him that your journey's end lies behind you. And she also tells him that the emissary's task is nearing completion. So at that point, they've just taken these two characters, our Captain Sisko and Gul Dukat, and just pitted them together, very black and white, good versus evil, one final battle in fire caves.
I think what's really interesting is that you really are bringing this down to a kind of meta type of storytelling, mm-hmm. and that the nature of the battle between the Paw Wraiths and the prophets, you know, it, what I loved is that it became about more than just between the Bajoran faith and this Paw Wraith faith. It was about the prophets protecting the entire Alpha Quadrant. Mm-hmm. So we've already just had a battle for the Alpha Quadrant, but what we didn't know is that the Paw Wraiths also have been waging a war for the Alpha Quadrant. And so on a spiritual level and a physical level, this battle has been raging. And I think that's what's really cool about this. And I love, you know, just as a person of faith, that what we get here is seeing that there's a spiritual plane and that there is a physical plane. And they coincide, that the battles that are raging are kind of one and the same, and it's for the heart and souls of people and their lives. It's really, really cool to me to kind of see that, and it puts it in that mythic sense of a story, so that Deep Space Nine as a whole is a mythology. It's not just fun stories.
Yeah, I find it interesting that the Paw Wraiths want to set the entire universe on fire forever. So there's no real motive. You know, this isn't like a political game or a philosophical game or an ideology or anything. It's just pure good versus evil. Evil wants to destroy everything. Just blanket destruction is what the Paw Wraiths seem to be after. Now, it was a little bit out of the blue for me because I didn't get that impression in the past that that's what the Paw Wraiths wanted. I thought they just wanted control of Bajor, but it seems that they just simply want to destroy everything.
And, you know, that is a very Judeo-Christian type of look at the fact that, you know, it's the devil who wants to lay waste to everything and bring everyone down, and it's God who's protecting us. And so you get that whole idea with the prophets that are protecting us. And
so let me ask you this, though, because when Kaiwin knocks out Dukat, when she gives him the drink and she's going to sacrifice him, when the Paw Wraiths first take over his body, my first thought is that Dukat is dead, and now his body is just a shell for the Paw Wraiths to speak. And it still feels that way while he's talking to Kaiwin. But then when Sisko comes and Sisko starts talking to him, it becomes more personal again. That no, this is actually Dukat, and he still has all the memories of Dukat, but of course he's possessed by the Paw Wraiths. Do you feel like this scenario where there's the devil, Dukat's the devil, but the Paw Wraiths are some kind of energy that's driving him?
When we say somebody's the devil incarnate, I think that's kind of where we're going. What was interesting in this is that, you know, Wynn thinks that she's going to be the emissary of the Paw Wraiths.
Yeah.
But again, Wynn does not have the dedication, the real faith. She's just in it for her own power, whereas Dukat's bought in completely, you know, to this whole Paw Wraith thing. He's the true believer, and it's fueled by the fact that his desires are their desires, which is he's going to be in control and everything burns because he's going to be there.
Well, I think where I was going with that too, though, is that even without the Paw Wraiths, Dukat has reached a point where he would like to be ruler of the universe himself. Like, he's the guy who's going to control everyone. Whereas, like you say, Wynn doesn't necessarily want to control everyone, right? She just wants personal power.
It is a really interesting thing to see, because I didn't catch that. I don't know if I've caught that before, the idea that the reason Wynn isn't chosen is because she really isn't a believer in this either. She's just kind of in it for her own little personal petty reasons. You know, Dukat's crazy enough to be on board with the plan of the Paw Wraiths.
Well, last thing on this point, some people criticize the ending of DS9 with the fire caves and all is, again, not being Star Trek, because it is mythology. It is this battle of good and evil. Symbolically, it does have extreme religious overtones to it. I mean, how do you feel about that in terms of it being Star Trek or just fitting into the story that they had established for this particular show?
You know, even Kirk said that in one of the episodes, you know, we already have a god.
Mm-hmm.
So even Kirk himself is a believer in something. So I think that Deep Space Nine is just a representation of the fact that there is something out there that a majority of the universe has a belief in, you know, that the universe itself, all of these different races all have their religions. The Klingons do. The Vulcans are a lot more spiritual than we give them credit for most of the time. Trills have their ideas. Bajorans have their ideas. Everybody has a religious aspect to their society. And the fact that all of these different religions would means there's got to be something to it. We talked to Kirsten about this a little bit with her latest book when we had her on Literary Treks, when he had been to certain places of worship, that he felt something that wasn't just the people worshiping, that there was something beyond. So I think that this idea is a really neat one for Star Trek to actually tackle, because it opens up the idea that we don't have it all explainable, and maybe we'll never actually be able to explain everything with science, because maybe there really is something out there that we can't define and put in a box and put under a microscope and reproduce in a lab.
Yeah.
I think that's a really neat thing to say, because it keeps us exploring. It keeps us challenging our ideas, you know, and if we always think that we have it in a box, I think we are more closed-minded than we actually are open-minded.
Yeah.
And so always keeping an open mind means there can always be something that I can't understand or explain that could be supernatural, because that actually could be the answer. You know, when you close your mind to that, I think that, well, I think you've closed your mind, and that makes you close-minded for that to not actually be a possibility, at least.
Yeah. Well, if you go back to the original premise of Star Trek, seeking out strange new worlds, that's, you know, if there's something coursing through the universe, then discovering that would be part of the mission, right?
Definitely.
All right. Well, we are pretty much at the end of the episode here. I guess as a final thought on the episode, to take us all the way to the very end, and we mentioned it up front, I just think that the way that they closed out the episode was perfect. To have Jake and Kira standing there looking out the window, the wormhole opens as Jake is looking, and you can feel like he knows his dad is over there somewhere. And I also think back to the fact that it's not the very first scene that we see in Emissary, but very early on in Emissary, when they arrive at the station and they're on the holodeck, Jake is there fishing, we get to see little Jake very early on at the start of the series. And then we end it with this grown man standing there. And he's with his father in that opening scene on that bridge. And then he's waiting for his father in the final scene.
It is an amazing scene. And we make fun of Jake in this show. And even Ira says that they kind of let Jake go in some ways. And if all the characters, he thinks that one probably got the biggest disservice, especially once they brought Cassidy on the show.
Yeah.
Seeing Jake stand there with Kira, and the fact that he is a man, and what I know beyond the show of Cirroc Lofton and the man that he became, and what people thought of him on the show, and he had become a much better actor for the show as you watched him go through. I mean, he really had come into his own. He had learned from some great people on that show, and just the character moment between him and Kira is it. I don't know if they could have picked a more perfect ending, because it hits every bittersweet mark that you want to hit. And as they pull away from the station and it becomes nothing but just another point of light,
yeah,
in the universe, it leaves you hurting and wanting more all at the same time.
Definitely. Well, that takes us to the end of the episode. So this was part one, where we're talking about some of the key story elements. And in part two, we'll get into a little bit of a look back at the final chapter and how we got there, as well as talk about some of the more specific character relationships that are wrapped up in What You Leave Behind, like Miles and Julian and Kira and Odo and such. But that is all we're going to cover for today, and yet this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
And then next week, it's like, hey, Worf, what's going on? He's like, oh, not much. Just, you know, yeah, walking around the bridge like I didn't have my spine grown, you know, last week.
Earl Grey.
You know, he's on the Enterprise. He doesn't have to be written into the movie because, hey, he's on the Enterprise. Everyone's on the Enterprise.
He gets a chair.
I mean, the whole beginning is all about his promotion. Yeah, exactly.
It's basically a Worf-centered movie now that I think about it.
The Orb.
Even Odo wasn't able to keep his, you know, quote-unquote hands clean. The fact that he has this kind of sordid past that we didn't really know about until now is really, really interesting.
To the journey!
I think the audience by and large, kind of saw Data as a machine and was probably a little more on the side of Maddox, as in Data is it, not he, and that sort of a thing, without even realizing it. And then Measure of a Man took us from that point to, you know what? This guy has the right to choose.
Warp 5.
The TV viewer who doesn't know anything about that, they're probably more like the actual people of the Enterprise era, where the idea that we would have these starships that can take us into the depths of the galaxy at Warp 5, this is all new for them as well.
The Ready Room.
Deep Space Nine is closer to the original series than any other Star Trek show in terms of ideals and, yeah, conflict. There is conflict in the original series.
Mission Log, a Roddenberry Star Trek podcast.
Wow. What's interesting, though, is this isn't even a threat. I mean, that be your last battlefield. There was a threat that Kirk was making in this episode. Picard's just like, yeah, we don't know who's taking our ship, and nobody's allowed to have our ship, so you know, let's blow it up.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
Although there is a certain darker aspect to the story than, let's say, one would find in Roddenberry's version of humanity, there is also room for hope.
Literary Treks.
I can see that Jean-Luc might have told her, you know, I was reading Janeway's logs, and can you believe that Q got married and has a son?
Continuing mission.
You're watching the Man Trap, and then for no reason at all, they go into the botany. Well, I want to call it the botany bay, even though I know that's not right. The botanical?
I think it's just botany room.
The botany room. And there's this person's hand in a pink glove as a space plant, and you're just like, what?
Melodic Treks.
The latest Thompson Holiday Company advert in the United Kingdom features William Shatner's rendition of the Queen's Bohemian Rhapsody.
Axanar, the official podcast.
And as soon as I got back to LA, I sat down and in about 3 or 4 days wrote this demo suite of 4 cues. And, you know, thankfully it resonated with Alec and Christian, and you know, here we are.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. You can find us everywhere you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, head over to iTunes or use the Podcasts app and please hit subscribe, even if you stream the shows through there. If you hit subscribe, that helps us out a lot because that helps us rise up in the search rankings and it helps other fans of Star Trek find the Orb as they're searching for shows. If you're not an Apple user, we have you covered in many places, including Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, Windows Phone, BlackBerry. We're also on SoundCloud. You can stream from our website, and you can even download the MP3 file from our website if you look in the SoundCloud player that's beneath the show art. In the upper right corner of the player, you'll see the button that lets you download the MP3 file. Plus, you can also grab the RSS link and pop that into any application that you like. And while you're getting your podcasts, if you have an extra moment, please leave us a star rating and a written review. We love to know what you think about the show, and that also helps other Deep Space Nine fans find the Orb as they're searching for podcasts. Now, we would love to hear your thoughts on what you leave behind. So if you'd like to send Matthew and me some messages, there are many ways that you can do that. First of all, you can go to our website, and there's a form at trek.fm/contact. Just choose to send to a show and choose the Orb, and that'll come to both of us by email. If you want to have a conversation, you can do that in our listeners group on Facebook called the Babel Conference. That's B-A-B-E-L. It's a closed group, so you do need to join, but you can get there by typing the Babel Conference into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website and click discussion up on the menu bar. Then just click join when you get there, and I'll let you right on in. And then, Matthew, we have a lot of great Deep Space Nine conversations with everyone there, don't we?
We really do, Chris. We've had some fantastic discussions about what we were even talking about at the end of the episode here with kind of religion in, in Star Trek and Deep Space Nine. Very respectful, some of the best discussions that I've ever had on the subject in a Star Trek setting, in this kind of setting with sci-fi fans where we get very passionate about what we believe.
Yeah.
And so I think I've just loved being in the Babel Conference, and I hope you'll join us there.
Absolutely. Yeah, I've been very impressed by the conversations we've been having there. as well. That's one reason it is a closed group, is because we want it to be for our listeners who enjoy our shows and want to have the same kinds of conversations that we have here on the show with us and other listeners there. Again, that's the Babel Conference, B-A-B-E-L, on Facebook. And then on Twitter, we're there. Our username is TrekFM. Plus, we have our regular Facebook page, facebook.com/TrekFM. And you can even send us a voicemail if you go to speakpipe.com/TrekFM. That's the word speak and the word pipe. Or look in the left sidebar on our website and you'll see the tool for that. And then you just need the microphone on your webcam or your smartphone or your tablet to record a message. And you can upload it to us as an MP3 file. All right, Matthew, when you're not helping Miles pack up the entire Alamo so he can take it back to Earth with him, where can people find you?
Well, Chris, you can find me on Twitter at MattRushing02. You can also find me doing Literary Treks with you, where we talk about the books and the comics of Star Trek, and I hope you'll join us there, especially if you enjoy Deep Space Nine talk, because we're frequently talking Deep Space Nine there with a lot of the different books or comics, things like that. I mean, even in the comics right now, the ongoing series, we're visiting Deep Space Nine with Q. So that's been a lot of fun. Yeah, so it's all over the place, that Deep Space Nine. And then, of course, you can also join me on the 602 Club. We just kick back, get a drink from Ruby, and talk about all things geeky. So hopefully you'll join us there as well.
Ruby's kids aren't allowed in the bar, are they?
No kids are allowed in the bar. This is strictly an adult place. We do serve adult beverages there, so hopefully everybody is of age.
All right.
And Ruby does do the ID checking as well. All so, right. Chris, when you're trying to decide whether or not you're going to be the new Federation ambassador to Kronos, where can we find you?
Well, you'll find me on the holodeck practicing my targ hunting, because I don't want to let Martok down.
That is a great idea. I wouldn't want to let Martok down either.
Problem is, I walked in the holodeck to start practicing that, and Barclay was in there, and boy, he was doing some stuff that I just don't even want to tell you about.
Please don't.
So now you can find me on Twitter. My username is C Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with the Y. I'm also on Facebook at facebook.com/CBrianJones, and I'm hanging out in the Babel Conference all the time, and I'd love to talk to you there about Deep Space Nine and Star Trek. And then elsewhere on the network, you can find me in many different places on many different shows, including Literary Treks with Matthew, as well as Warp 5, Continuing Mission Matter Stream, Hyper Channel, The Ready Room, and also the official podcast of Star Trek Axanar. So tune into those if you want to hear more of my thoughts on the world of Star Trek. All right, Matthew, well, it was great going through this part of the discussion today with you. I'm looking forward to part two. So everyone, tune in next time, and we're just going to continue talking about the final chapter.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll see you next time as we gaze into the orb. Thank you.